So I'm sorry I cannot be there. I'm in Portugal for an IMTC meeting, but the guys were nice enough to organize the schedule so that I could participate even remotely. So what I wanted to do today is, guys, I'm getting too much feedback. So if you could mute the room, maybe.
Yes,
you could
yes,
mute
yes,
the room
I'm
and then.
Fine.
Okay. So, what I thought of doing today is obviously the focus is multi-point video server architectures. There has been a lot of developments over the past several years in this area, and this is also something that a lot of the people who participate in WebRTC are not necessarily familiar with. So, you know, I've been participating in the WebRTC Expo events over the past several years, and I see that there was a, you know, people had to sort of be educated about what has happened in this space, you know, not just, you know, recently, but, you know, historically as well. So we have new, you know, new designs in this space, and that's where scalability, simulcasting, and this concept of the SFU come along. And, you know, prior to video, by the way, where I'm, again, I'm a chief scientist and co-founder. Before video, I was a professor of electrical engineering at Columbia University. So I was involved in video communications from very early on. I started my PhD in 1990. So as you can imagine, basically, I've seen essentially a big part of the history of all this technological development. So what I thought it might be useful for everybody is to actually take a historical view of where we started, what happened, and how we got to where we are today. Because I think that can help a lot, especially younger people, to appreciate what is happening, what is the trajectory, if you wish, that we are on right now as an industry in terms of multi-point video. And so hopefully we'll understand better what's coming up ahead. So in my presentation, I'll be showing video streams. And the way these are created, obviously, you get a series of frames. You know, you encode them. You segment the data into packets. Those packets are transmitted as a RTP stream. And I'll be depicting that in my presentation as a series of little boxes with an associated name and an icon to go along along with it. So if you look at the timeline for multi-point video, it spans, you know, more than 30 years. So it starts from the late 70s up until today. And there have been a lot of important developments in this in this timeline. I would like, again, we have some time today, so I want to make use of this time to highlight some of these developments, because I think, again, are very relevant for what you guys are that you guys are doing. So, you know, the very first element of this type of things that we're using today, video codecs, is, sorry, was RAID control. I'm sorry. By the way, I'm using a, for those that are not familiar with, I'm using a movie which is created out of Keynote presentation. The reason being that, you know, Keynote is, takes too much CPU, and it's easier to run it as a movie. Okay, that's why you see me basically sharing this movie file. Okay, so right. So in terms of RAID control, the first one is work that was done in Compressor Labs back in 1978. This was the first time that the RAID control with adaptive quantization was designed. Then what today we recognize as a hybrid codec, which is the basis for all the codecs that are used even to this day, was back in 1981, this design of the block-based motion estimation with transform coding. And again, that's something that permits all video codecs that exist today. That was 81. In 94, Pixotel was founded. In fact, there was a, you know, Greek guy there, the Tuzos, okay, with a historic company in this space. Now, the first mention, actually, of something that we would associate with multipoint, it was a continuous presence design that was published, actually, in the proceedings of the IEEE back in 85. This actually involved multiple, two sites, but there were multiple views from within each site. So it was not a true multipoint, even though it was a multi-person, if you wish, session, okay? Then we had the first video phone by Pixotel. Just to get a sense of it, of the cost, it was 2 times 52 kilobits, 7.5 frames per second with 11 hardware boards, 11 bar boards, and the cost was $150,000 for the pair. Okay. So then the one of the interesting patents in our space came around from Compression Labs. I think Compression Labs probably the most relevant early company in doing digital video compression. And it became very well known because it was later used, or maybe I should say abused, in the context of JPEG. So that was a pattern that gave, you know, essentially was used in a by non-practicing entity, you know, to extract licensing royalties from users of JPEG. And this is something that this issue, you know, of patents is something that is actually with us even to this day. Right, this issue of how patents are used within our space. Now, 261, the first video codec really in this whole family of codecs that we're using to this day, was done in 1988. Okay, so the first digital video compression standard for communication. Back in those days, there were separate codec designs for video communication and for entertainment codecs. So there were, you know, different approaches. Later on, these two efforts were actually merged, and so now we have a single codec that is used both for communication and for entertainment. Now, Polycom was founded in 1990, one of the, you know, biggest companies to this day, right? And the first instance of what we today call a multipoint control unit was from Compression Labs back in 91. So it was able to do 8-way or 40-way, 14-way with cascading. Now, let's see how this switching MCU actually works. It's very simple. You have on the left a number of inputs. I show three in this example. And what the MCU does, it will just select which one to send the output. Okay. In this instance, the MCU selected input B and just copy it over and transmit it to the output. So that's something that takes very little processing, right? Very little delay as well. But of course, you are limited in that you can only see one participant at a time, right? And at a specific But that's a very easy way to support multipoint, right? Now, the first instance of a H.261-based switching MCU, that would be a standards-based switching MCU, was in 92. I found a reference in the IEEE Communications magazine. And in fact, it was one of the early European projects, Esprit. That was one of the early efforts in collaborative research from the European Union. That was way back in 1992. A very interesting project in multipoint, in my mind, was the Cornell University CU-CIMI project. That was done in 93, and it was using a reflector. So people would transmit streams to a reflector, and the reflector would just copy those streams to its output and transmit all of them to the receiving endpoint. As far as I can tell from the historical record, if you wish, this is the first instance of a multi-stream endpoint. In other words, an endpoint that receives multiple video streams and does its own decoding. Okay, that's, by the way, how WebRTC works today, right? So the first instance of such a design was back in 93. In fact, at the time, I was a PhD student. By the way, I'm still getting echo. Yeah,
Alex,
if you can mute it, that'll be great.
Can I ask you to restart the presentation? Because we did not see, actually, the presentation.
What? Sorry?
We cannot see
really?
Your presentation, actually. Can you please start again the presentation, the slide share? Sharing the slide?
I can, but I'm sharing it right now, so I don't know why you cannot see. I see it as shared. Are you guys...
Okay. Anyhow, please go on, and maybe we will ask you to get your slides and put together after the two streams.
No, I can restart it, but let's make sure you do see them.
Okay. Not yet.
Does anybody see my slides?
No, sorry.
I see them as shared from my interface here, from my computer.
It should work. We tested it and it
worked. In fact, I see the shared myself. I can see myself on my window, on my video window, I can see my slides shared. So whoever is using video desktop right now, the remote people at least, should confirm that they're receiving it.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Yeah, Pedro Rodriguez says he can see it, right. And Rob Bristow as well. Yeah, but echo is bad, of course, yeah, because of the room system. But what's going on with the room system, though? Are you guys, did you select to see the share? Make sure you select it. If there are multiple shared windows, you have to select the right one.
It is connected to RMX 4000 Polycom MCU.
Oh.
Anyhow, please go ahead. No, we will.
Well, it's a pity because, you know,
for the presentation and
the. Well, unfortunately, there is a lot of animations on the presentation, so.
I see.
That won't work. I mean. What else? If you are you recording it?
Yes.
You could use a streaming URL and just, you know, pop it up on a separate window in the room.
We are recording it
on your browser
with different technology. Not video.
Ah, okay. So not video replay. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Because on the replay, you could get the URL and just you could view it from a flash, whatever player. Yeah, I'm trying to think what is the most productive. Okay. Look, maybe I can continue and try to elaborate more on what might be on the screen. That's right. But again, for some things, for diagrams and stuff, we should have tested it earlier, right? I assumed, because it was a video option, that would work as well with content sharing.
It worked before. We tested it.
Okay, tested. Okay.
Yes.
Look. Okay. Let me continue then. Okay, no worries. Okay, look,
sorry.
Let's continue. We'll make the video available to everybody after the event. That's the best we can do at this point. It's okay, let's keep going maybe. Eh?
Thank you.
Okay, and again, for whoever is remote, you know, I'll still be using the slides. So, you know, you can see it there. Another thing you can do, by the way, people can join the video desktop from their computers within the room. So if they have the URL, they can join. Of course, you should mute, right, video and audio. But they will be able to see the slides from their computer on their desks in the room. That's another option, right? So if you send them the meeting URL, they can just join through video desktop and just get the slides. Okay, that's a possibility. All right, so I'll continue. So I was saying in 93, we did some work on what's so-called X-Phone project. This was point-to-point audio and video using motion JPEG hardware and Sun workstation. Okay. And in fact, you can still get the code for that today. If you Google it, you will be able to find the code, download it, probably compile. But all the versions for the APIs is probably going to be very old. That it was the first time we had a fully functioning point-to-point protocol for synchronized audio and video on the same screen, and they were actually multiplex video and audio transmitted multiplex, not transmitted separately as was the case with M-Bone. Now the first instance of a transcoding MCU that the first reference I could find is from a paper in 1994, and so this was the first time that people described what today we refer to as a transcoding MCU. Now, the transcoding MCU does the following. It receives a number of streams. Let's say in this diagram that's shown, there are four. And what it does, it will decode everything, recomposite the image, and re-encode it and transmit it. So there will be a completely new stream produced at its output. And this example that I'm showing will be E. Brand new stream. And again, it contains video composed by decoding the incoming streams. Now, this is very flexible because you can design whichever layout you want, okay? But it takes a lot of processing because you have to do the decoding and re-encoding. And worse, it introduces a lot of delay. In fact, delays in the order of 150 milliseconds to 200 milliseconds going from the input to an output of a transcoding MCU are very typical. So that's one of the reasons why multi-point communication has not seen a lot of deployments because it has been a very awkward experience in the past. And a key reason why it has been an awkward experience is because of this very significant and non-trivial delay. Okay. Now, a solution to that was a trick that people could do with a so-called mixing MCU. And the first one was done in 94 using H.261. This requires a special feature from the video coder in order to work. And the way it works is that the MCU will basically copy-paste low-resolution video that it receives from the participants into a high-resolution video to its output. But it will not decode and re-encode. It will just change headers, and it will take the encoded data and paste them in the output, okay? So in this particular example that I'm showing on the screen, you'll see the incoming streams A through D, four of those, that are copy-pasted in the output, so it's the same coded video data, just with different headers, okay? So again, this doesn't take a lot of processing, right? It doesn't have too much delay. On the other hand, it only supports specific layouts, and of course, you can never see any participant in high resolution, right? Everybody's just shown in raw resolution, but you know, it's a good compromise between the two. Now, in 95, MPEG-2 was done, and MPEG-2 is a video codec that is used basically in all the early digital television systems, in DVDs, and so on. And again, that was a separate design from the H.dot series of codecs, which are geared towards communications applications, okay? RTP was done in 96, okay? And 263, a much more mature codec for video communications was done by the ATU, okay? So we are already now, you know, 20 years, this is a 20-year-old design. Of course, there were several annexes created after the fact. And 323 came around in 96, and basically, you know, to describe ways to transmit all these H.dot series coded data over IP. The Polycom View Station, the first Polycom video product, was done in 98 and had the 323 over IP with 261 and 263 video, and it supported four-way embedded multipoint, okay, with active speaker switching, all right? Then STP was done in 98 by Hanley and Jacobson, and then SIP, of course, was done in 99. So then, you know, then there was a period of sort of inactivity, right? Until 264 came around, and in fact, in 2003. And it was actually a very interesting development because it did represent a leap forward in terms of codec performance. People did not believe that it would be possible so soon to have a compression performance so much better than MPEG-2 that it'd be commercially interesting if you wish to deploy a new codec. So people were surprised by the innovation that the committee that created this showed. And I think, you know, that was a very huge development because it was the first codec that was actually used both for entertainment video and for communications video. And the ramifications of that, by the way, are significant in that because the entertainment industry is much bigger than communications industry in terms of pure dollar amount, people develop chips for the entertainment industry, not necessarily so easily for the communications industry. So having the same codec design for both is very advantageous because, you know, the same silicon can potentially be used for both. So that's not something to be ignored, especially in a mobile world, okay? Now, the RTP APLR format came much later in 2005, right? And you can see, well, already, you know, 6-7 years of quiet period in terms of video communication. So 264 came out, payload format came out, and then video was actually founded in 2005 by Ofer Shapiro, Avery Moore, and myself, originally called Layered Media. And the reason video was created, you know, the technical innovation that we identified we wanted to bring to the marketplace had to do with the user scalability in video communication, packet video communication, okay? And it had two components. First, it used scalable coding as a tool, okay? And the second component, maybe most important, is we want to introduce a new architecture for the MCU, okay? And the video codec was a tool to make that happen. So SVC was finished in November 2007, We actually participated in its development from 2005 when the company was founded, right? I actually served as the editor of the conformance specification. We donated bitstreams, conformance streams, content for performance evaluation and what have you. So let's take a quick look at how SVC works. Again, I apologize, you would need the video to see the animation associated with that. So with traditional video coding, you encode video as a series of frames where each one, uses the previous one as a reference, right? So that creates a chain. It's very effective for compression purposes, but if you lose any of those images, you're in trouble because you cannot decode anymore. And so that's one of the reasons why single layer coding has not been very effective in packet-based video, just because as soon as the packet loss rate exceeds something like 3%, this whole thing breaks down. And then you have to resort to either, you resort to FEC techniques or other techniques that have not proven to be particularly effective, especially when we have burst errors, okay? So with scalable coding, let's talk about temporal scalability first. You take, in my example, one every four frames, right? And you code them as a single layer. So again, you will encode each one using the previous one as a reference, okay? Notice that the frames are now, they have four times the distance between them, okay? Now, you have three more frames now in between that you need to encode. And you'll create two additional temporal layers. The first layer will get the middle frame and use the immediately previous frame of the lower layer as a reference. Here I'm using the most recent T0 picture, right? So now I have two layers, the T0 layer and T1 layer. The T0 is 7.5 frames per second, the original over four. If I add the T1, I'm up to 15 frames per second, half of them. And there are now another two frames remaining to be coded, and I'll use the most recent pictures again from a lower layer to encode them. So the first T2 will get T0 as a reference, and the second T2 will get the T1 as a reference. So now I have three layers that allow me to do 7.5, 15, and 30 frames per second of the same video content. Okay, so that's temporal scalability. By the way, notice that if I lose any of the T1 or T2 pictures, the high layer pictures, okay, I won't be able to show it on the screen, but it won't affect my capability to keep decoding, okay? So, in fact, users won't even notice that one of those pictures are missing, right? It's one picture out of 30. But what you definitely want to do is want to be able to continue decoding. So what is relevant in that respect is the lowest layer, the lowest temporal layer, the T0. What you want to do there is, if you miss one of those pictures, is receive it, not to display it. You want to receive it to be able to decode the following T0 picture. And actually, a very nice trick that we introduced and actually made it also available in all the RTP payload formats for all the video codecs that are used today, is to detect that if you lost a T0 picture very quickly with the very first packet you will receive, and so request that it is retransmitted. Okay, so you send an ACK, and whoever is upstream from you can immediately retransmit it. Again, not because you want to display it, because you need it to keep decoding the T0. Now, you could not do this with a single layer coding because the frames were too close to each other. They were like 33 milliseconds apart. These guys are four times apart, right? So if you have 130 milliseconds, so there's plenty of time typically to detect the error, request the transmission, and receive it so that you keep decoding, okay? So that's makes a huge difference in terms of error resilience. And this can actually absorb, something like 20% burst error rate, okay? Which is definitely where you want to be if you want to transmit this type of content over networks like the one I am right now. I'm in a hotel in Portugal, right? Over Wi-Fi, communicating to you in Budapest, right? Who knows what my stream is experiencing. Now, the second dimension for scalability is spatial scalability. And here, the idea is that you take the original video, you downsample it by two in each dimension, so if you're one quarter of the pixels, you code that, and then you use that information to as a reference to encode the high resolution image, okay? So you use the low resolution picture as a reference for the high resolution. So this way, in this example, you have created two layers, a base layer and an enhancement layer, right? If you get the base layer, it allows you to show the picture in low resolution. If you get both base and enhancement, you can show the video in full resolution. These typically are multiplexed in the same stream and are transmitted together, okay? And that's how I'm going to be showing it in my presentation, okay? Now, pros and cons. Again, you're spending more bits for compression purposes, so it's 20% more bits than single layer. Okay, but you do get the superb resilience. One way to look at this is that this is like insurance, or like four-wheel drive. It will consume more gas, But then on an icy road, right, you won't risk of totaling your car. And of course, you give yourself room for adaptability because, you know, you have a data and then you can extract a subset of the bitstream and it will allow you to render the video in a different fidelity point in terms of either frame rate or in terms of resolution. Okay. So that's scalability. Now, scalability is already in 264. It's already in VP8 in terms of temporal scalability. It was not designed with that in mind, but it actually supports temporal scalability. 265 has temporal scalability in its version 1 and in its version 2, which is called scalable HEVC or SHVC. That's available since October 2014. And as you may be aware, we are working with Google in adding spatial scalability and temporal scalability in VP9. And that's actually an ongoing progress between video and Google. And I hope that will be complete, you know, sometime later this year. Okay, it's very relevant for WebRTC. Okay, so you know, RTP topologies came out in January 2008, and I think that's it's very interesting in the following respect, that it defines the topologies that people foresaw as being the ones to be deployed using RTP. And I think it's interesting because it was published in January 2008. Video came out with its product in February 2008, and the architecture of what we proposed is actually not reflected in the RTP topologies. Okay, so it was a completely new design, and that's very relevant, by the way, because as you can imagine, since it was not has not been foreseen as a possible design, none of the standards at the time that were designed around RTP were able to take care of what this new architecture tried to do. Okay, that's very important because that's something that we as video and as a community have been trying to fix, you know, ever since with significant progress, I'm happy to say. So video launched at that time in January 2008. So we were the first to come out with a solution that used SVC, okay? But more importantly, we introduced this so-called video router architecture, okay? So how does it work? With the video router, the server receives multiple streams, all of them encoded in we're using SVC, okay? So they're scalably coded. So you get a base layer, let's say for simplicity's sake, and an enhancement layer for every stream. What the server does, it will select which layer from which stream to forward to a particular participant, okay? In the example I'm showing here on my screen, from the blue participant, you get both base and enhancement layer. And for the green and yellow participants, you only get the low resolution, which is the base layer. Why? Well, maybe because you don't want to see them in high resolution. Maybe you don't have enough screen real estate to show them. Maybe you don't have enough CPU to decode everything. Or maybe there's not enough bitrate available between the server and the endpoint to transmit all the data. For whatever reason, the server selected to transmit to you this data. So the process is very simple because, again, it doesn't require any computation, right? But most importantly, is extremely low delay. We're talking about less than 20 milliseconds in and out from a device like that, right? Because it does not have to do any processing of the video data. So that's a very significant improvement. Because again, previously, you know, you would not be able to operate at a performance level that would be good for interactive communication. You know, below 180 milliseconds end to end. Whereas here you can, okay? So that makes all the difference in terms of user experience. There is also a very important aspect of what's going on the endpoint itself. The endpoint has to be multi-stream, so it has to be able to receive multiple streams from the server, not just one video stream, but multiple. And it is the endpoint that does the composition, the decoding, first of all, of the streams, and the composition, okay? And if you think about it, that's very similar to a web browser. The web browser gets content from the web server, right? And it's the browser that's the decoding and the rendering. Now imagine how the web would look like if we require that the web server does the rendering of web pages and it transmits to you a pre-rendered web page. We would never be able to scale the servers to support thousands of users. So pushing the complexity to the edge, that's a very important lesson that time and time again we have learned on the internet. In video conferencing, we have not been able to implement it, right, until the introduction of scalable coding, okay? So that's a very important distinction. And of course, this is a perfect match for WebRTC. And this, of course, predates WebRTC by many, many years. But you know, WebRTC fundamentally is also multi-stream. It's the receiving endpoint that will do the decoding of the multiple video streams that it might be receiving, and it will do the composition on the browsers or whatever, the device's screen, okay? So what do we gain out of all this? We get error resilience, mostly from temporal scalability, but spatial scalability is also important for error resilience. We get rate matching. We can adjust to whatever rate is available to us. Personalized layout, okay? All of this without any processing from the server side. It's just, you know, these are forwarding decisions, really. It's inherently low delay. You have error localization because all the retransmissions only happen between over the problematic link, let's say between a server and a receiving endpoint. It won't affect those that do not have a problem in their transmissions. It's inherently low complexity, and it also allows cascading. Very important because, you know, you can put multiple of those devices along the path from one user to the next without making it untenable, okay? So, and again, all this with no signal processing at the server, all right? So if you look at what happened after 2010, so let's just zoom in on that part of the of our history. And again, there is an animation on my slides that shows the different all the different elements of the timeline. So after video launch 2008, a lot of things happened. First of all, we had a UCI forum formed, and it did certification interoperability for SVC systems. So that was actually started by Microsoft, and it defined specifications for SVC streams for UC communication systems. Skype came out in 2011 with multi-point video. Sorry, I just went too fast. So Skype came out multi-point video, up to 5 participants as a premium service, and it's free as of April 2014 with up to 10 participants, okay? That came out, that again, initially came out in 2011. Okay, the payload format for SVC finally came out in 2011. Notice that was 4 years later after the codec came out. Part of the reason was the complexities in dealing with scalability. I mean, that introduced a lot of discussions in the ITF community, and a lot of things had to be sorted out before this could be published. Now, hopefully this has been sorted out, and then we can keep moving forward faster in future codecs. But it was the first instance where people have to look at a scalable codec and understand how it's supposed to work, okay? WebRTC, the first release came out in 2011, okay, in terms of source code released by Google, okay? So things start to get interesting now. The VP8 RFC in 2011, in November, okay? Now, a very interesting development happened right after that, in that all the companies that are in the traditional video conferencing space, okay, came up with SVC-related products and announcements, okay? So RadVision came out in September 2012 with support for SVC in one of their MCUs. So he was using it mostly for error resilience, not to design a new type of MCU, okay? However, Microsoft actually started using SVC with temporal scalability for its error resilience properties, and they use what's called simulcasting in the Link 2013 product, okay? Now, how does simulcasting work? With simulcasting, what you do is you create, instead of doing spatial scalability with scalable coding, what you do is you do two separate encodings of your video stream, one in high resolution, one in low resolution. So there are two independent encodings, and that's why in my diagram, I saw the streams are as not connected to each other. This means they're independent of one or the other. So you can take the high resolution stream and decode it by itself. You don't need the low resolution stream. And so notice that if you do that, by the way, you pay a premium because this is much more expensive in terms of bits. The premium for simulcast will be about 50% of a single layer, whereas for SVC, it will be 20%, right, or thereabouts. And in fact, you know, it is interesting because SVC was criticized in the early days as, you know, spending more bits on single layer. Well, the benefits were so significant that people later on were willing to pay even the premium of simulcast coding, which is even more than SVC, to get to some of the benefits that you would get with SVC. So I think that's very interesting. Now, how does this work? So again, the endpoints would do the multiple encodings, the simulcast encodings, and transmit them to the server. And what the server does is, as with a video router sort of design, right, with SVC, what it would do is select which layer from each participating endpoint to transmit to a receiving endpoint, okay? So in this example, I'm showing, again, the blue getting high resolution and the green and yellow getting low resolution. But for the blue, you don't need the low resolution blue stream to decode the high resolution. You only get the high resolution stream. So there are pros and cons in this design. Again, one of the cons is that you overload the path from the transmitting endpoint to the server. And if you are on a DSL line, for example, that's not the path you want to overload, okay, with more bits. Okay. One of the benefits, though, is that the top layer by itself is decodable by what we call a legacy endpoint. And as a result, it's attractive for companies that have a lot of legacy distribution. It also has some benefits in terms of flexibility in dealing with each layer independently because they are transmitted into their own streams. At any rate, this is an alternative design that a lot of people have used. So as I'll explain later, I coined the term selective forwarding unit to refer to these types of architectures. And this covers both the video router design with SVC, as well as designs that use simulcast coding. We'll get back to that in a second. And again, Polycom also came out in October, same time frame, right, with their own support for SVC. In fact, I think they were supplying codecs to Microsoft as well. So at that time, it's very important to know that at the end of 2012, the entire industry basically acknowledged that VC is the way to go for video communication. All the major players had either made announcement or actually shipping products that used SVC in one shape or form. Okay, very important. The WebRTC conference was started in November 2012, and the UCIF published its first specification in terms of SVC modes, how to configure a scalable codec for unified communications. That was published in December 2012. Okay, and that's a specification that is used by shipping products. Now VP9 became public in February 2013. There was a draft describing it. And 265, another major development, came out in April 2013. Okay, so that was 2 years ago. And already, of course, it had made a big dent, if you wish, on the entertainment video. We have not yet seen it affect video communication applications. Now, a very important development here is Google Hangouts. So, Google is a video customer, and they came out with Hangouts originally using our H.264 SVC solution in May 2013, and that was using special scalability. Later on, Google decided that they wanted to rely on VP8 as a codec of choice, so they switched to VP8. Because it doesn't have special scalability, however, they switched to simulcasting, and that's how Hangouts works. It uses temporal scalability for error resilience and simulcast to get to this kind of like multi-layer design. At the same time, when this was announced, we also announced that we would work with Google to develop the scalable additions to VP9, okay? Because VP9, as it was originally designed by Google, was not done as a scalable codec, not even for temporal scalability. So that's something that we've been working on ever since. And again, this is a project that's going well, and I hope you will see the fruits of that later this year. So finally, in terms of specs, Magnus Westerlund and Stefan Wenger were developing an update to RFC 5117, the RTP Topologies RFC. And that update, it incorporated these new designs. So again, I coined the term selective forwarding unit. The guys liked it and they introduced it, and so that's part of that internet draft that you can check out today. It's still a working group draft. But finally, we have an academic name for these sort of designs, which is very important because, again, without it, it would be very difficult to discuss it and actually develop standard signaling support for these types of devices. Okay. So, talk about signaling. Within UCIF, the UCI forum, we created a new group called the main group for MediaWare Network Element to examine signaling for these types of SFU designs. The reason being that we realized that different companies had different implementations for signaling, right? And we need to figure out a way to have a common ground. So the chair of that activity is Bernard Aboba, which you may know, is from Microsoft, right? And he's an architect in the Skype division. And the hope of that group, which, by the way, since UCIF has merged now with IMTC, is now an IMTC group. And I am in an IMTC meeting right now, by the way, in Portugal. So this is an active group that examines all the signaling support that has to go along SFU designs. I think it's very important. The transport for SVC was done in 2014. So that defines the subset of the RTP payload format that you see companies, you know, have to use in order to enable interoperability. So that I think is important for those that use SVC. And the RTP available format for VP9 started in October 2014. In fact, now there are co-authors of that from Video. Danny Hong joined them. And in fact, we sent the code to go along with that to Google just recently. So my hope is that Chrome Fit 45, you will see actually that code being incorporated. And most importantly, it will include this temporal scalability error resilience trick that I've been describing to you. It will be part of the code. And that's very important to get good performance on error-prone networks today. If you use VP9 today, which you can, you know, it's behind a flag, etc. If you use it, it will not have this feature, and so it will offer very poor experience from an error resilience point of view. Okay, so be warned that this is something that's there. Okay, so 265 is out there again with special scalability, and so it will definitely play a role, you know, down the road. Right now, in terms of the WebRTC space, right, we are under the dual codec mandate, right? So the mandatory to implement codecs are both 264 and VP8 for browser devices, for browser endpoints, and for non-browser endpoints, the same is true. You do both 264 and VP8. However, if one of the two, presumably VP8, is determined to be, you know, royalty free, you need to, well, the royalty free will become the mandatory, and the other one will become an optional. But right now, both of them have to be part of browsers and non-browsers alike. So that's where we are today, okay? And I think, you know, if we can take a look at this, at the timeline, I think what is significant is that, again, in 2012, everybody switched to scalability. Right now, there are two ways to do advanced servers. One is with scalable coding, SVC type, whether or not it's, you know, ASA264 SVC, scalable VP9 or what have you. The other side is sort of like doing it on a simulcast approach. So, but I would consider both of them scalable designs, okay? And they have, again, pros and cons, okay? But that's, you know, this is really what has happened. And I think now we're getting to a place where you will see, you know, really second generation products in the marketplace, okay? Now, at Video, we have utilized this environment in terms of, portfolio products. Let me just slide a little bit back. Sorry. Yeah. I'll be very quick in pausing my little video here. So at the core of our products is a video router, right? But then there is an associated video portal for user management. There is a video gateway to talk to legacy systems and so on. On the endpoint, though, you have everything from portable devices, you know, from mobile devices like iPhones and iPads or Android devices, all the way to video rooms, then video panorama, multi-monitor systems, you know, for very large, you know, sets of or screens. And the fact that you have scalability, that allows everybody to participate, and everybody will get the most out of their of the equipment that they are using, because the others do not have to compromise because of the scalability. Just because a low resolution participant joins doesn't mean everybody has to switch to this low participant. And of course, this stuff can be in the cloud, it can be on premises, right? And we have all this virtualized. A good example of how this is used is CERN, and there's a very nice animation. Again, those guys that are not seeing the slides won't be able to see it. What I like about CERN is the scope of the deployment. They have, you know, 18,000 users. They have 800 simultaneous connections, up to 168 simultaneous 3-to-3 and SIP connections, and they have 12 access points worldwide. They have two video panorama systems, and they can do 12 simultaneous recordings. And in fact, you know, CERN is a global organization these days. They have users, you know, from all over, and, you know, they write papers with hundreds of authors. So these guys have to collaborate somehow. So they have a system where they have servers, you know, within Europe, but also in Asia as well as in North America. So you know, I have two portals, 24 routers, 10 gateways, 12 phone systems, again, around the world. And this is, by the way, these are old slides in the sense that these guys have been expanding. So CERN is you know, they decided to switch over to video exactly because they could get, you know, tremendous scalability in terms of how easy it was to keep adding stuff to the system, and the fact that they could actually have very large conferences with very low delay, so that the technology will become transparent in terms of the user experience. Now, what is very relevant for WebRTC is that video, you know, when we started out, we were selling to OEMs, original equipment manufacturers. So the code was structured around a core set of SDK for which we created an API through which we were building our own applications. Okay, so that's how video was done from the get-go, because that's how we started selling. And this is something, by the way, that you know, that's available regardless of, you know, something like WebRTC. So as the company grew, what we saw was that we started from, you know, the traditional video conferencing environment with room systems. Then we went to UC, Unified Communications, where people had, you know, their own devices, iPhones, and so on. But then, you know, quickly people wanted to start and to want to embed video in their own applications. So as a company, we saw a lot of our partners, like companies in healthcare, that they were doing, you know, ICU cards, and they wanted to be able to add video on that card. So they got our code in the form of an SDK, you know, C code SDK, and they incorporated in their own product. Another example is, you know, Nintendo Wii U. Okay, so then too, they wanted to be able to add video to their product. So they appreciated that they could get, you know, an easy to scale server plus an SDK that they could incorporate. Okay, now as you can imagine, this sort of philosophy is at the heart of WebRTC. I think one of the biggest benefits, as far as I'm concerned, for WebRTC is the fact that it allows people to incorporate video into their own applications. So, you know, I don't care much about, you know, the codec aspects. You know, we can discuss them if you want. But I think what's most important and what is transformative is the fact that there is an API now that allows everybody to incorporate video into their own applications. I think that's huge. So the way we have been incorporating it into our own, if you wish, infrastructure is the following. You know, we have our video works platform that includes the router, the portal, gateway, and our own APIs. So we already have, regardless of WebRTC, we had a native web browser plugin, something you download, you install on your browser. That did, you know, software-based encoding, decoding for SVC, and it has its own signaling. On top of that, we had a JavaScript API, an associated web service API on the server side, and with an API of our own that was of our own design, right? And then as a programmer, you just write your code on top of that. So what I'm showing here on the diagram, the yellow part, that's something that the application developer would create. The green stuff is interface that video is specifying, and underneath in blue is the infrastructure. So when you go to a WebRTC environment, the way this works is that, you know, you have a WebRTC endpoint, okay, a browser endpoint. Then there is a WebRTC server component on the video infrastructure, okay. And if you use GP8, you know, it will obviously have to do transcoding to take care of that, okay, if you want to talk to an SVC infrastructure. On top of it, there is a JavaScript library, which we call the VideoWorks WebRTC JavaScript library, that's provided by Video. And what this does is it takes care of all the video-specific signaling, right, to talk to the VideoWorks platform, okay? On top of it, there is a JavaScript API, which is the same API that you would see if you had the native video plugin, okay? So you can see that underneath the JavaScript API from Video, you now have the VideoWorks WebRTC JavaScript library and the WebRTC browser endpoint, okay? As a programmer, though, you don't need to be concerned with that. You just see one application API, okay? So that's a way that we've been, you know, taking care of the WebRTC environment today, to be able to bring WebRTC endpoints within the video infrastructure, okay? But most importantly, and, you know, thinking that for us, WebRTC is essentially a...
What's
significant is that when you have WebRTC 9 available, right? And that's, again, that's going to happen later this year. Instead of having VP8, let's say, and then having to transcode to something else or doing a simulcast or what have you, you'll be able to use scalable VP9 throughout this infrastructure without any signal processing whatsoever. So it will natively flow through the whole thing. So you can benefit from all the other aspects of this design, the cascading, the, you know, the recording, and of course, you know, you can still do gateway to legacy systems, right? But on a normal connection, you would not need to do that, okay? So that sort of, you know, design. So we have already released actually in November this WebRTC server with a sample API in November 2014. And any day now, today or tomorrow, actually, I've been told, we'll release a version 3.2 that has a video-branded WebRTC client. So you as a user, you won't see a difference in functionality if you use the web browser plugin from video client, or if you use the WebRTC-based video client. The user experience will be the same. Okay, so that's, you know, that's pretty neat. And the way that it works again today is that you have a WebRTC server and you connect through VP8. If you need to talk to the SVC infrastructure, you need to do transcoding. Okay. If you're going to go through the video router, okay, with the version 3.3, which is it's not announced, but you know, I guess talk about it here. It's okay. What happens is the streams will natively flow from a VP8 to a VP8 participant. You don't need to do any transcoding. That makes sense, right? You only need to do transcoding if you want to go over to the SVC infrastructure, okay. But again, even that, in my mind, that's an interim, you know, interim solution. What you really want, and that's what, you know, we're all shooting, is what I call a WebRTC Server 4 in our, if you wish, versioning, where essentially all the WebRTC endpoints talk scalar VP9, and then this flows natively throughout our entire infrastructure, okay? And then you get all the benefits of scalability, both temporal for resilience, but also spatial, both for adaptivity, and for LLGs as well, okay. So that's, you know, that was my presentation. It's been on the long side. Again, thank you for your patience. But hopefully, again, I thought it was very important to touch upon the historical aspects of this, because hopefully, it gave you a much better sense of where we are today. So you are, you know, more informed in terms of trying to extrapolate where we will end up, both, you know, near term as well as long term. Okay. In passing, just because it came to me now, I should mention that there are a lot of open source implementations for servers. Okay, like Zichi comes to mind, right? Zichi is essentially, as far as I know from Emil, it doesn't do simulcasting. It's multi-stream. You have multiple streams going to the server, and it'll just forward the appropriate streams, not necessarily with simulcast log. Okay, so I think what you're seeing, you know, you're seeing open source implementations that capture some of the technical elements of the, let's say, more advanced commercial implementations, and that's typically going to be the case. If I want to leave you with any concluding remarks, is that what I'm seeing is that a lot of the open source stuff, including the WebRTC stack, it incorporates a lot of the things that as an industry, we have agreed that it has to be part of every implementation. And that's why, again, video has made available all these, you know, error resilience tools, you know, available to the whole community. But of course, there will still be techniques that are only part of the more sophisticated solutions, for which, you know, for better or for worse, you have to pay a premium. But as we proceed, as we progress as an industry, you know, the lower bound, if you wish, the quality that you will get from open source, from free, will keep increasing. But hopefully, of course, also the top line, right, the capabilities and the features you get from the paying solution should also keep increasing, okay? And, you know, there is a place, I think, for both. Okay, that's what I had to say. Thank you very much. You can unmute the room.
Thank you very much. It's very appreciated that...
you can take, I don't know, time-wise, if we have time, we can take questions. I'll leave it up to you guys.
So it's very appreciated that we had a very detailed and...
Yeah, I apologize. I don't have the last version of the map. I apologize. Yeah, these were slides, you know, this particular animation was done about a year ago. So I apologize if it did not accurately represent the current state of affairs as said. So if anything, it's even bigger. So, yeah.
Can it hear us?
I'm muted.
Questions?
Okay. Can you hear me?
The room is muted.
Sorry, can you hear me now? Room is muted. Let's see. Yes.
I'm sorry, I cannot hear you.
You're right.
Okay, there you are.
Okay, so it's appreciated your very deep and technical presentation, and I'm very thankful to be here today. And I know today is a big interoperability event, and from PEXIP also cannot participate in person and be on this event. And so I appreciate very well that you could make this this presentation despite this. I don't know if you have a question.
I'll have to. And they're calling me from the meeting, so yeah, maybe a question or two, just quickly. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if you have any questions to the presenter. I don't know if remotely. I will unmute everybody. Sorry for the technical.
By the way, feel free to reach out. It's alex@video.com. Feel free to email me any question. I'll be more than happy to answer. It doesn't
Alex.
Have to be now or real time. Yeah.
This is Peter from Géant. I have a quick question. So what I've realized is that the browser vendors play a very important role in this entire ecosystem. So can you please describe your relationship or discussions with the various browser vendors and how you push or enforce any specific implementation of the WebRTC stack inside the browsers?
Yeah. We're working very closely with both Google and Mozilla, the Firefox team, okay? So in terms of the features and support, so as you know already, Chrome can do simulcast, that's VP8, it will be able to do VP9. Mozilla are supporting 264, and in fact, they have in the roadmap to support simulcast in November, if I remember correctly, 2015. So they are very much aware. I gave them a similar presentation to the Firefox team. So they are aware also of the benefits of, you know, simulcast scalability, temporal, and what have you. And I think the roadmap is very much aligned with that. So in terms of, you know, the capabilities that will be available at the browser level will be there. So that's also very important for the community here. The application developers have to also be aware of what's necessary and make sure they use these features. In other words, this might be a feature that you need to set a flag, right, in the WebRTC stack. So what I hope is that people realize that this is important stuff. You know, it's important to have it in the browser, and it's important to use it in the browser because it will make a huge difference for the user experience, okay? So thankfully, again, we are in very close contact with the browser manufacturers, and my hope is that, you know, again, others sooner, others later, right? It depends on the resources they have. You know, they will support that. So unfortunately, I don't have anything to say about Safari. I know that Microsoft has just started implementing Get User Media, right? There's a whole story there in terms of how Microsoft will support WebRTC. That's a very big question, right? I think that it's clear to me that they are totally committed from a networking point of view, right? So what goes on the wire will be very much WebRTC or WebRTC-like. Things are more complicated on the JavaScript API, you know, with ORTC and all that. We know that they will not support. They will not implement WebRTC 1.0, right? So they are participating in the ORTC effort, and which some people refer to as WebRTC 1.1 or WebRTC Plus, but this is still something that's been debated. Like this Get User Media support apparently has started on Microsoft Edge, you know, the new generation browser. So that can only be a good thing. But that's, you know, that's as far as my information goes. I don't have it. I work closely with Bernard Aboba from Microsoft within IMTC, right? But I don't have visibility on the roadmap, on the product plans, or whatever, right? None of that. And guys, unfortunately, I have to leave because there is a board meeting that started, you know, 16 minutes ago, and I have to run to that. I truly apologize. Again, I'll be more than happy to answer any question by email. Okay.
Excellent.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I have also one question. You mentioned about VP9 my question is, I get you correctly, so it will open technology. You are working together with Google, the VP9, scalable coding, and will be free to implement in browsers like Firefox and Chrome also.
Yeah, absolutely. It will be part of the WebM distribution. In fact, you can even today maybe you can find traces of the code because, you know, pieces of the code have been uploaded to the WebM project even since back in November. So you might even be able to find some traces out already. Okay, so definitely this the scalable V9 will be part of the V9 distribution, and then it will be essentially available to anybody who's using that stack.
Yes, we saw that in Chrome there are VP9, but I guess it could be enabled with some hidden switch. But
it's not ready yet. Yeah, yes. It's not fully baked. It's not fully baked yet. That's why it's in the experimental features.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you again.
Okay, thank you guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you very much.